Dan Feldman here. Welcome to Locked On Pistons, part of the Locked On Network. Follow us on Audio Boom or subscribe on iTunes. While you're there, check out Locked On Lions, a Lions podcast with Matt Derry, also part of the Locked On Network. I'm joined today by Patrick Hayes, who wrote with me at Piston Powered. I like to say that I'm the founder of Piston Powered because it's accurate, but in a lot of ways, Patrick was a co-founder. He's the best Pistons blogger on the internet, not really valued as much as he should have been at MLive, so he happily came over to Piston Powered, and I'm sure a lot of you have read him there over the years. Sort of dipped into retirement a little bit lately, but thankfully we've got him back talking Pistons again. How are you, Patrick?
I'm great. That's a very PC version of MLive's reaction to my moving over to Piston Powered.
Well, you were undervalued, right? Like they let you hit free agency before they should have.
That's true. I'd agree with that. They also before my time under appreciation of how rude I was to their commenters before I started being rude to your commenters.
Yeah, I'm sure we've got plenty of listeners here who like just hear this name like, oh yeah, that guy, like he was a real jerk to me.
That's my hope. That was if I can spur that reaction, then my job is done today.
So Patrick and I got to know each other. We were both working for the Flint Journal, both from the Flint area. And so I think that gives us a unique appreciation among people covering the Pistons or who have covered the Pistons about the Pistons' connection to Flint. And I think maybe even more so than Detroit, which obviously has its own distinctive basketball culture. Maybe Flint has the most distinctive, the strongest basketball culture in the area among the wider area of God, I hate to use this term, but Pistons Nation, of the places where people are predominantly Pistons fans. And so I wanted to have Patrick on a little bit to talk about the Pistons Flint connection in basketball in Flint, because I do think there are parallels and there's a strong connection. There's a real affinity for the Pistons in Flint and vice versa, especially lately. Patrick recently wrote a chapter for a new book, Happy Anyway, a Flint anthology. You can find that at beltmag.com. It's $16, and if you're interested in Flint, and especially Flint basketball, which Patrick just did a tremendous job writing about in a very honest way, in a way that does not overly romanticize it, does not inappropriately romanticize it, but there are romantic elements. He touches on those. He touches on the real problems and how Flint basketball has evolved since, maybe the Flint basketball you're familiar with and the big thing that everybody knows Flint for is the Flintstones, a group of players from Flint who played high school there, who went to Michigan State, helped Michigan State win a national championship, one of whom, Mateen Cleaves, went on to play for the Pistons. And we'll get to them a little bit later, I'm sure. But first, I just wanted to ask you, Patrick, when you sat down over however long the course was to write this chapter on Flint basketball, how did you decide, what tone you would take? Because I think a lot of times when people write about Flint basketball, they just sing the praises and mention all the great players who've come through Flint, some who've gone on to the Pistons, gone on to other teams in the NBA. How did you decide to take this much more sober and real outlook on Flint basketball?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. First and foremost, I should credit the editor of the Flint Anthology, Scott Atkinson, who's also another former Flint Journal employee. But one of the challenges I have as a writer sometimes is how much of myself is appropriate to inject in a story versus not inject. And I think my initial drafts of that, I wanted to do a good job of just telling the story of, my observations of Flint basketball. The reality was, for the time I covered it, I was a participant in it. And Scott did a really good job of kind of drawing more of that out. I started off with something that was more, I would say, book reportish. Really the compelling part of that piece, and the part for me that was rewarding to write is, you know, by the time I'd gotten to that beat, and you saw it some yourself, you know, when during your time working in Flint, you know, Flint basketball wasn't really Flint basketball anymore. You know, it doesn't mean that the kids we covered weren't great and, you know, fun to go to those gyms and watch them. You know, but the reality is the because of all kinds of, you know, socioeconomic issues and different things going on in Flint, you know, the massive population loss, you know, Tom Izzo wasn't coming to hang out in those gyms and watch kids, you know, during those years. And we're talking, you know, late, 2008-ish to about 2010 is kind of the time period I cover in the more modern part of that chapter I wrote. So I really wanted to, you know, before I was a journalist, I was, you know, a history major in college, and, you know, so history is a big part of what I like about writing. So I wanted to do justice to some of the history of Flint basketball, because it really is amazing for a city, you know, for a city this size. You know, I would argue there might not be a small city in the country who has a better just sports in general reputation than Flint. You know, the caliber of athlete this city has cranked out in a wide range of sports over, you know, the past 60 or 70 years is insane. And so I wanted to do justice to that while also kind of sharing some of the experiences of the kids I met, you know, who were chasing really what was this insane dream. In a lot of cases, getting advice from adults who I would say were mostly well-intentioned, but also pretty ignorant of, you know, the opportunities that these kids actually had. A lot of kids I met, you know, had serious classroom issues in terms of grades. They wouldn't have, even if there were Division I college opportunities waiting for them, they wouldn't have necessarily had the academic capabilities to get those. And, you know, I think that a lot of those kids probably had some, you know, they had the ability and kind of the passion for basketball to, you know, play it, you know, mid-major and those type of schools and be contributors. But they were also, you know, they didn't project as, you know, the star prospect, the type of prospect who, you know, a university would work really hard to help ensure that kid becomes academically eligible and can qualify. You know, it wasn't, you know, the college sports being what they are, you know, the basketball prospects represent, you know, an investment, you know, and you wouldn't see even smaller Division I universities take the time to make sure any kid they saw some potential in, you know, would you know, take the steps necessary to be academically eligible. So, you know, what you saw is a lot of kids who just weren't going to get the college opportunities they thought they were. And then, you know, coaches and other mentors in the community who didn't even have an understanding of how they should be, you know, directing those kids, whether it's to junior colleges, whether it's, you know, NAIA or other places where they could have actually gone to college for free, got some of the academic support they needed, probably not had the opportunity to play professional basketball, but that's okay if you're getting a free education. So that was kind of the inspiration. That struggle was really kind of compelling to me as an outsider. You know, I could kind of see it happening, but you know, when you're covering it as a reporter, you don't necessarily recognize it. And kind of the hindsight of now having, you know, 5 or 6 years since I was doing that on a full-time basis, you know, I still think about it a lot. I think about what happened to those kids. And, you know, in a couple of cases that I mentioned in the chapter, there were a couple of pretty incredible stories of, you know, kids, two kids from Flint Northwestern who went through some, you know, insane challenges and, upbringing issues. And in one case, you know, a right place, wrong time kind of situation with that got him in legal trouble and ended up, you know, taking this roundabout kind of path to college basketball and ended up, I believe he's it's Dominez Burnett is one of the ones I'm talking about. He went on to play at Davenport. And I think when he just wrapped up his career there, and he don't quote me on this, but is I think the all-time leading scorer at any level of college basketball in the history of the state of Michigan. So he went and had this, you know, incredible NAIA career, you know, potentially can find himself an opportunity to play professional basketball overseas now, you know, finished college and got his degree. And, you know, the other kid on that team, that Flint Northwestern team, DeAndre Parks, who was kind of, you know, he was a good high school player, kind of one dimensional, didn't play defense, liked to chuck threes a lot. You know, and honestly, and you covered that team a bit too, you know, when there were three or four people who I probably would have picked as better prospects than him, but he ended up moving out of Flint. He had some serious academic issues. Someone at the school once told me that he kept getting waivers to play, even though he had a 0.0 grade point average during his senior year. And he ended up, you know, going to a junior college down south, ended up at NDSU and played in, you know, was the second leading scorer on a team that made the NCAA tournament this year. So, you know, another kid who struggled for a long time, but now has himself in a position where, you know, he may get paid to play basketball somewhere. And, you know, those are two pretty cool stories that came out of that experience. And I wanted to, you know, go back and kind of revisit that.
So, you mentioned that he thrived moving out of Flint, and I think we've seen, like, that's a path a lot of people look to take. That, you know, Clarissa Shields, gold medalist in boxing, Flint's obviously very proud of her. She's very clearly proud to be from Flint, but she moved to Colorado to train because that was a better environment for her. And I'm curious what you think about how that ties to the Pistons and the struggles the Pistons have had at the Palace drawing attendance. I don't think Bill Davidson, I don't think the fact that it was close to Flint, you know, definitely closer than any of the other Detroit major teams play, was a driving factor for why he put the Palace in Auburn Hills when they decided to build it in the late 80s. I think it was the two biggest things were, you know, if he was going to pay for it himself and not use taxpayer dollars, that's where land was a little cheaper. It was also closer to the Detroit suburbs, the wealthier suburbs, where you might be able to get more ticket buyers. But there are definitely people who come from Flint regularly, people who used to come from Flint regularly to Pistons games. And do you see ties between the economic and population decline of Flint and maybe some of the reasons the Pistons are having trouble drawing fans?
Yeah, I mean, you know, being lousy for about a decade certainly didn't help their ability to draw fans either. But yeah, certainly there's, you know, Flint as a community, you know, when you look at poverty and, you know, education, you know, so I think there was a mid-decade census done a year or so ago, and Flint's population is actually projected to be less than 100,000 now for the first time in, you know, since, you know, the 1930s, I believe. You know, so a city that at its height was about 200,000 people has now lost, you know, over 50% of its population. It's lost it's lost a significant number of the automotive jobs that were the driving force of the economy here. So when you look at the people who remain, and, you know, I still work in the city of Flint, and, you know, there's certainly a lot of things to be proud of and excited about here. But if you look at the people who have remained, you know, a big reason they've remained is because, you know, they don't have the option to be able to, you know, get out. So I think that certainly impacts things like, you know, having disposable income to, you know, pay for entertainment. And, you know, I think you can also tie it some to, you know, the identity of the team, and that's thankfully changing, you know, some over the last couple of years, you know, particularly this year. I think that you saw some of the old the old toughness and trademark, you know, Pistons basketball that it's been known for at its peak. But you know, one of the interesting things you said in the intro that I'm going to tie back to on this is you know, mentioning Detroit and its basketball culture. I think if you look at the Pistons at their two real peaks, you know, during the Bad Boys era and then kind of the going to work era, if you look at the identity of those teams, it's actually much, much closer to the identity of what you would call true Flint basketball than what you would call Detroit basketball. You know, when you look at Detroit and they've placed, you know, Detroit's had a ton of talented players come out of there too, but there's a lot more kind of flashiness and I would say a more flamboyant style of basketball. You know, Chris Webber is, you know, the never known for his defensive abilities, you know, but you know, Jalen Rose, guys like that, some of the recent big names who have come out of Detroit. Whereas, you know, Flint has always been this super blue collar. When you look at what the Flintstones did at Michigan State, you know, when you look at some of the high school teams who were great here at Flint Central and Flint Northwestern in the 80s, there is a toughness and kind of a team first ethic to Flint basketball that I think people really here really connected with those Pistons teams that embraced those things. And when you saw the Pistons, particularly after, you know, Joe Dumars decided to, you know, blow up that core, they moved to trying. They didn't successfully do it, but I think the clear intention was to be more of a finesse team. And I think if you look at a place like Flint, they're very offended by that sort of basketball. And you've been in, you know, I mentioned it in the chapter in the book. One of my favorite games that I covered was Flint Northern playing Detroit Country Day, and they were outmatched for sure, because that was a good Country Day team with Ray McCallum was the top player there, and then
Ray McCallum, now a Piston.
Yes, and they Northern decided to employ the only place I've seen this is, you know, I grew up in a rural school district, and anytime we play a big big school, let alone a urban team, the coach of our team would always employ the let's just hold the ball at half court and run clock, you know, because there's no shot clock in high school basketball. And Northern started doing that against Country Day to kind of limit the number of possessions in the game, make it a shorter game, stop them from, you know, running up and down the court. And the crowd just went insane, because that's just such a soft, or the perception is that's a soft style of basketball, whether it's, you know, whether it's effective or not. People were still really offended by it. It wasn't that they couldn't even get in a discussion about, you know, whether the strategy was the right strategy. It was just like, this is Flint. You know, this is you're in a gym where teams have won state titles here, where, you know, incredible players in the history of the state have played there, and you're employing, you know, that junk strategy. So, you know, that I think that's why, you know, that's the, you know, along with, you know, certainly the significant economic aspects of it, the fact that the identity of the team shifted away from that blue collar approach to basketball, you know, that's also a contributing factor to, you know, to why people would or would not travel from Flint to Auburn Hills for games.
Yeah, that's an excellent point about how maybe the Pistons at their best have more mirrored Flint style of basketball. I do think a lot of the talk about the Bad Boys and the going to work Pistons mirroring Detroit is not necessarily about the Detroit basketball players as much as the culture of Detroit as a city on the whole, and everything going on with auto workers and the toughness that Detroit produces, even though it manifests itself differently on the basketball court. I want to flip the script a little bit, though, to talk about the other side of it, and not just the impact Flint is having on the Pistons, but the Pistons are having on Flint, and how you've seen that evolve over the years. Obviously, the big thing now is Tom Gores, who's from the Flint area, making a big push to be active in trying to fight the water crisis in Flint and raising money and giving his own money to provide water for Flint. But it's not new. This is not the first time there's been a Pistons to Flint connection. The Pistons drafted Mateen Cleaves, maybe because he was from Flint, although if that was part of the logic, even at the time, I much would have rather had Mo Peterson. But even beyond that, the, you know, going back, Chucky Atkins coming to play in the Flint Pro-Am, how have you seen the Pistons' impact in Flint evolve? And specifically, you know, where is it at now with probably Tom Gore's, what he's trying to do for the city, the major driver of the Pistons' connection?
Yeah, sure. Obviously, Tom Gore has made a significant financial commitment to the city to, you know, support it through the water crisis. But, jokes about, you know, how many buttons he leaves unbuttoned aside. I think as a philanthropist, I actually have a lot of respect for how he goes about it. You know, he's not overly flashy about it. And the fact is he was contributing to a lot of things in the Flint area, you know, prior to the water crisis. He was active in supporting some of the things that the Boys and Girls Club here, for example, was doing. And there's a lot of, in my day job, you know, I work with a lot of members of the philanthropic community and community organizations here in Flint. And, you know, there's always a belief that, Tom Gores will step up and support, you know, good, positive things happening in the city. I think he saw him kind of double down on that and the water crisis with, the Flint Now shirts that the players all wore during the game, when that was announced were super cool. And I actually was at the Palace for my birthday, like a week after those shirts, and, you know, was trying to get one, and, you know, they were already, you know, they sold them out all. So I think it showed, the shirts, and the fact that they, you know, got rid of them so quickly showed, you know, that there's an affinity for Flint around the state of Michigan. And, you know, something as terrible as the water crisis happening, the silver lining of that has been, you know, a lot of positive kind of love and support for the city from really all corners. And, beyond just Tom Gore, you know, Rasheed Wallace has been to Flint twice now, just going door to door, handing out water. One was fairly recent, like less than a month ago. So, and that's, you know, what you've seen in Flint on a daily basis. You know, when the water crisis was getting, just saturated with really international media coverage in, you know, the early part of 2016, you saw all kinds of celebrities here, you know, capitalizing on it. And Rasheed Wallace was here then, but now, if you're in Flint, the celebrity part of that has fizzled. And the fact that, you know, Rasheed came back, I think he lives in North Carolina now, he just came back randomly. Even the local media here did not know he was coming. And then all of a sudden, you know, someone got tipped off that, you know, Rasheed Wallace is carrying cases of water around neighborhoods in North Flint and just knocking on doors and handing them out. I think other members of the team came and did, you know, water distribution events here. I believe Andre Drummond was here once. So it's been
Marcus Morris has been there.
Yeah, sure. Marcus Morris was up here. I think that the sports community as a whole has there have been athletes who have no real connection to Flint who have been here because they've played with people from Flint. They know people from Flint. Tracy McGrady, I don't think has been here, but over the years he's had two or three just like random quotes talking about Flint basketball. And it's because he played in high school with Corey Hightower from Flint Northwestern. And, through that connection, you know, Flint's on his radar as a, you know, as this incredible, you know, kind of basketball city.
So I want to interject real quick. You mentioned Corey Hightower, who maybe some listeners don't know about Corey Hightower if you're not from Flint. Almost everybody who is a basketball fan in Flint knows about Corey Hightower. Because his reputation in Flint is to a certain generation. How old is Corey Hightower now? About what year would he have been trying to break into the NBA?
So he's a little younger than Kobe Bryant. So he would have been, So I'm trying to think. So it would have been approximately like early 2000s. So 2001-ish would have been.
So the reason Patrick mentions that we know he's a little younger than Kobe Bryant is because, as the legend has it in Flint, Corey Hightower may be the best basketball player to come out of Flint. Just all his ability. And he goes to Lakers training camp. Part of his hazing is he has to carry Kobe Bryant's bags. Corey Hightower refuses. And I'm pretty, Corey Hightower has denied this, but he refuses. And, he's, as far as an NBA player, he's a bit player. He's expendable. And so the Lakers cut him rather than, cause some type of feud with Kobe, who's a franchise player. And, I think that has helped preserve Corey Hightower's legend in Flint, that he's so great and he never had the chance. Like Mateen Cleaves, there were people who thought Mateen Cleaves might have been the best basketball player from Flint, but he went to the NBA. He was a flop. He couldn't shoot. He wasn't fast enough. And so he could not be an NBA player, and that hurt his legacy. Corey Hightower never had to deal with that. Like, it's still the myth of Corey Hightower. But like him, there are just so many Flint basketball players who've gone to the NBA, Pistons or not, where it's just stunning how strong the legacy is. And the one I'll bring up, reading your chapter, I had absolutely no idea that Latrell Sprewell spent time growing up in Flint.
Like, yeah.
It's so stacked with players that, Eddie Robinson's the one I heard about, who he didn't play high school basketball in Flint because his grades weren't there. He wasn't focused on school. He was just hanging around in the gyms with other Flintstones. And that's Eddie Robinson, who played for the Bulls a little bit, the Hornets a little bit. But was just like playing great in these pickup games, but just not interested in high school, so therefore couldn't play high school basketball. But Latrell Sprewell tried out his freshman year, didn't make it, and then moved to Wisconsin, I think, to Milwaukee to actually become a prospect. And so that leads me to the other thing I wanted to ask you about was whether in reporting for this chapter, I don't know how much original reporting you did because you spent so many years covering Flint and, obviously have this wealth of knowledge about it before you wrote it for this book. What surprised you the most in learning about Flint basketball?
I think it's along the lines of what you just mentioned. Basically, it's the amount of debate over who actually is the best player the city's ever produced, because clearly, it's Glenn Rice, and it's not even close. Glenn Rice got MVP votes a couple of times in the NBA and, had an amazing career at Michigan, had, maybe not a Hall of Fame NBA career, but a very, very, he was a very good player for a long period of time in the NBA, won an NBA title, was the best player on playoff teams for both the Heat and Hornets. Objectively, there's no argument that would seem logical that someone could put forth that it's not Glenn Rice. And if you talk to people who have lived their whole lives in the city, who have been around the basketball scene, they will argue all the time with you about who it actually is. And it usually, there's not a wide range, but it usually boils down to Glenn Rice, Corey Hightower, or Eric Turner. And, you can tell generationally, who you're dealing with. It's an older crew that will still insist on, Eric Turner, who was former Michigan player, and he was actually drafted by the Pistons too in the second round and didn't make the team out of training camp, and then played professionally overseas. But Eric Turner is Corey Hightower before there was Corey Hightower, where it's kind of the urban legend of him, and then the fact that he never did actually have a chance to play in the NBA has added to his legacy, where it's like Glenn Rice is hurt by the fact that he's an NBA All-Star, because there's people who will say, well, if Eric Turner would have got a chance in the NBA, he would have been the MVP or something. And you can't, you can't argue with something that is so, circumstantial. But it's,
well, sure, if you can.
Well, you can, but you're there's no winning an argument. you know, Turner is really, really interesting too. You know, Hightower is kind of his legendary status, you know, his hot-headedness is pretty famous, you know, for you know, punting basketballs into the crowd during games and stuff like that, you know, along with his talent. You know, you have you know, I mentioned Tracy McGrady, you know, who Hightower actually played with him at Mount Zion after he transferred from Flint Northwestern. And it, you know, there was an interview, and I'm, you know, going to paraphrase it badly, but, you know, McGrady insisted that Hightower was the most talented person he ever played with. You know, so when you get guys endorsing you like that, you know, it just adds to your legend. And Turner is interesting because he during in high school, you know, there were people in Michigan who insisted that, you know, he's the next Magic Johnson, and only better. And you can go back and find, you know, press clippings where, you know, columnists who covered high school basketball in Michigan at the time would argue that, you know, when you hear descriptions of how he played, he was like, you know, today's NBA point guard, the scoring distributing hybrid point guard that's so prevalent with, you know, guys like Westbrook and, you know, the lead guards who can run an offense if they have to, but they're also, you know, in a lot of cases, the best scorer on the team. That was Eric Turner in the early 1980s. And, you know, there's a Lansing State Journal column from that era where, you know, like Magic, who got the Magic nickname in high school because of his passing ability, you know, Eric Turner was this flashy, dynamic passer too. And they called him ET, not just because of his initials, but, you know, after the movie E.T., which came out when he was playing at Flint Central, because he was known for looking one way and passing the other way. And so he had this distinctive style, this charisma, this, you know, element to his game that was really dynamic and drew people in, that was probably ahead of its time even, you know, and I think had some personal issues and things like that in his life that kind of derailed or at least hindered his career. But, you know, you know, both he and Hightower are guys that people in Flint will legitimately argue were better players than Glenn Rice. And, you know, as insane as it sounds, you know, there's evidence based on, you know, stuff people have said about them that, you know, they're not crazy for saying that.
Right. Eric Turner was drafted by the Pistons in 1984, obviously right as they were into their ascent into becoming a championship contender. They'd win two titles, yeah, and they had a deep team.
I think they had a pretty decent point guard at the time.
This is mistaken, true. So. Right. You got Isaiah Thomas, and you just have a deep team. And that's part of what made the Bad Boys so good was their depth. Not necessarily room for him. He doesn't get the right crack at the right moment. Drifts overseas. Other things get in the way. You know, it's definitely a case of what could have been. I have a hard time believing he would have been better than Glenn Rice. But yeah, if you want to make that case, it's hard to refute that, like, with absolute certainty. I have a decent amount of certainty, but no, I don't have absolute certainty. How could you? And so those are the kinds of, you know, one, that's the Pistons' connection to Flint. The Pistons and Flint are intertwined. That year in 1984, it was a 10-round draft. The Pistons also drafted Ben Tower from Michigan State, Dan Pelikudis from Michigan. Probably just butchered his name. Neither one made the team, but, like, you know, you'll have a hard time convincing me that they didn't draft those players, at least in part because they were local and they got to see them more and scouting was a different thing. So Pistons and Flint are inevitably intertwined. There's a real proud basketball history in Flint that the more you learn about it, the more you can walk away amazed. Like, I was amazed by Latrell Sprewell. Spending time in Flint, you were amazed by, you know, the talk about who's the best. And there's all kinds of things like that. That's why I definitely recommend picking up Happy Anyway, a Flint anthology. You can find it at beltmag.com, $16. Patrick's chapter on Flint basketball is just fantastic. I really, really recommend picking this up and reading about it, and you'll get a better understanding through it of the Pistons and what the Pistons are and how they are and when they give back to Flint, when they come back to Flint, when Tom Gores gives money, when Rasheed Wallace goes to Flint, you know, why they're doing that and what that connection really means. You can follow Patrick on Twitter at Patrick_Hayes. I'm at Dan Feldman NBA. You can subscribe to Locked On Pistons on iTunes, or you can follow on Audio Boom. Thanks for listening.